Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Denver Metro News, read by Matt. Today we'll be reading the following main articles. Denver Roller Derby keeps sport thriving 20 years on. King Supers take steps to handle strike. And parents, new tax credit could net you thousands. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Denver Herald Dispatch, week of February 13th, 2025. Denver Roller Derby keeps sport thriving 20 years on. By Eric Hines. Eric at cotln.org. Photograph accompanying this shows three women playing roller derby. Caption is, members of the Denver Roller Derby junior teams compete in January during an event to kick off the year. Photo by Eric Hines. The Denver Roller Derby squads are gearing up for their next seasons, and to start the year off, various teams that play out of the Overland Neighborhood Rink competed against one another in late January in friendly exhibition matches. There are several levels of travel teams that practice and compete under the Denver Roller Derby umbrella, as well as junior levels. Denver Roller Derby was established in 2005. Skaters at the January opening weekend events at the 2375 South Delaware Street rink said they got involved with roller derby because of the great community and competitive nature of the sport. The stands were packed for the opening event. Elizabeth Bohr, also known by her derby name, L on Wheels, said when she moved to the city a little more than 3 years ago, she started researching roller derby leagues and found her South Denver spot. I like just the community, the fact that there's so many people and we're all involved in so many different things in Denver, said Bohr, who mainly plays in the jammer position for the Denver Roller Derby, C-tier home team. It's great to just have connections and also just have, like, a family. It's just a giant family. One of the skaters for Denver Roller Derby's Mile High Club team, the top-tier travel team, is Miss T. Maven, originally from New York City. Maven said she has been competing in roller derby for nearly 20 years, and she said she will try to compete for a spot on Team England during the upcoming Roller Derby World Cup. It's really the only sport in the world right now, or one of the only ones, that is women-centric and women first, and for people that identify as a woman or non-binary, Maven said. The women's version is more popular than the male version, and I feel like it's one of the few sports that actually celebrates women just as awesome. Photograph accompanies, members of Denver Roller Derby junior team compete in January during an event to kick off the year. Photo shows women in helmets, uniforms, skating in almost a race formation with one woman in the lead. Although camaraderie and empowerment are what Maven said she likes best about the sport, she also enjoys the challenge and the physicality that comes with roller derby. The Denver Mile High Club has been ranked regionally by the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, which sanctions the league in which the team competes. As a girl, you can finally hit someone. And it's like, you don't have to be dainty and feminine and all that, Maven said. You can just really enjoy beating up and hitting on your friends, and everyone loves it. Jana Sims, the public relations director for Denver Roller Derby and a board member of the organization, skates under the name Royal Tenenbaum. Sims said she was looking forward to the upcoming travel team tryouts in late February and early March, which is something the standbys have never done before. Standbys are part of the developmental teams that help skaters improve their skills. For anyone who hasn't been to a roller derby match before, Sims said, people should expect a very high energy. I would say it's very high energy, Sims said. It's a lot of fun. It's a great community with probably like the nicest people I've ever met in my life. It's super high impact, high energy. So if you like full contact, that's what we do. More information about Denver Roller Derby can be found at denverrollerderby.org. The 2025 Denver Roller Derby schedule, February 22nd, juniors and adults home team doubleheader. March 22nd, juniors and standbys versus Boulder doubleheader. April 5th, juniors and Denver versus Fuego Latino doubleheader. May 3rd and 4th, altitude adjuster tournament. May 24th and 25th, Colorado Chaos tournament. June 14th, Standover's doubleheader. August 23rd, Adult Mixer and MHB versus Santa Cruz doubleheader. September 27th, Juniors and Adults home team doubleheader. October 3 and 5, Goosebumps Tournament. October 25, Juniors and Adult Mixers doubleheader. November 22nd, Juniors and Adult Home Team doubleheader. And December 13th, Juniors and Adult Home Team doubleheader. Advertisement on this page is for DirecTV, your go-to game time destination for pro football. Contact your local DirecTV dealer, choice package $84.99 a month, IVS Holdings 877-328-1512. King Soopers takes steps to handle strike. Grocer hires temp workers to keep stores open. By Tamara Chuang, The Colorado Sun. As day one of planned two-week walkout began, about a dozen King Soopers employees were up before dawn on Thursday, pacing in front of their store in Centennial. Some walked in the perimeter on the sidewalks as cars passed by. All carried white signs with red lettering, asking customers to not patronize their employer. Their union representative with United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7 forbade them to speak to a reporter, even as one employee questioned, why not? Why aren't they allowed to tell the people why they are outside the store instead of inside? At a Safeway parking lot across from a King Soopers on Thursday, union officials held a news conference and said the workers at the two Pueblo stores would join the strike starting Friday. Local 7 President Kim Cordova said she spoke for the workers, who feared repercussions by the employer. Intimidation is part of the union's multiple unfair labor practice claims against the Kroger-owned chain. King Soopers has some big problems. I mean, when you have 96 to 100% of the workers vote to strike, there's real issues, Cordova said. And here we are for the second time in back-to-back bargaining cycles. Here we are with another unfair labor practice dispute against King Soopers. More than 10,000 King Soopers employees in the Front Range are involved, which is a few thousand more than 3 years ago, when King Soopers walked out in January 2022. More contracts have expired. They're protesting unfair labor practices, which allege surveilling and disrupting discussions between workers and union reps. A last, best, and final offer from the company was rejected in mid-January. Photograph accompanying this shows employees on the picket line. Caption says, employees on strike hold signs outside of King Soopers in Denver's Capitol Hill neighborhood on February 6th. Not all union members walked out on day one. Workers in Colorado Springs voted last Friday to authorize a strike, but some of their contracts have not yet expired, so they could join in the coming days, union officials said. Find an updated list of affected locations at public.flourish.studio/visualization/214-90216. Grocer preps for strike. There are 77 Denver area stores involved in Thursday's work stoppage. Because of that, King Soopers hired temporary workers to keep the stores open, spokesperson Jessica Trowbridge said Wednesday. We have an obligation to the community to make sure they have access to fresh and affordable food and pharmacy services, so we've gone ahead and hired temporary staff to come in and help us serve the community at this time, Trowbridge said. All stores will remain open, though locations impacted by the strike will operate on limited hours. Stores will open between 7 a.m. and 8 p.m., with pharmacies open 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. during the week. On Saturdays, pharmacy hours will be 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closing from 1 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. for lunch. Pharmacies will be closed on Sundays. All other stores in the state, including city markets, will stick with their normal hours. Other King Soopers stores remain open. Not all King Soopers in Metro Denver are unionized. There are non-union stores in Brighton, Castle Rock, Erie, and Firestone. There are also two Thornton locations, at 13700 Colorado Boulevard and 13525 Quebec Street, that aren't part of the strike. Other non-union stores farther out include Bennett, Conifer, and Windsor. Union stores outside of Denver remain open, though they could join the strike at a later date. Besides Colorado Springs workers who are ready to join the strike, others could take a strike vote soon. Labor contracts in Fort Collins, Greeley, Longmont, and Loveland expire February 15th. Also, many locations only have some of the staff in a union, such as the meat departments in Boulder and Parker. But those stores are still impacted by the strike and limited hours. Local 7 also represents workers at 4 Western Slope City markets, including 2 in Grand Junction, 1 in Fruita, and 1 in Clifton. No strike vote has been announced yet. Unproductive negotiations, heated accusations. Negotiations began in October on the new contract, which expired January 5th, and stopped indefinitely on January 16th. No further meetings were scheduled. In unfair labor practice claims filed with the National Labor Relations Board, the union said King Soopers was, quote, illegally threatening members with discipline for wearing union clothing or union buttons, surveilling workers in discussions with union staff, and, quote, gutting $8 million in retiree health benefits for wage increases to active workers. To get the union back to the bargaining table, Cordova said, we need the company to engage in good and fair bargaining, and they need to resolve the unfair labor practices. They have to provide information that we need around sales. King Soopers pushed back on all the allegations in a statement. The company said it responded to all the union's requests and even, quote, dedicated 6 hours to answering every question raised during a one negotiation session. The company has, quote, acted in full compliance with both the law and collective bargaining agreement obligations. It filed its own unfair labor practice claims against the union for causing disruptions, such as mentioning a strike on December 17th, and rejecting company offers without providing their own proposal for the workers. The union said it has made proposals. The company had hoped to avoid a strike like the one 3 years ago. Earlier this week, King Soopers President Joe Kelly asked Local 7 to reconsider their approach and prioritize the best interest of our associates, their members, and the community they serve. King Soopers has publicly shared its offer to work to workers and urged employees to look and vote on the proposed contract instead of voting on unfair labor practices. King Soopers offered raises to boost store clerks' hourly wage by $4.50 over 4 years, with top clerks earning above $27 an hour by 2028. Adding in health care and pension benefits, that would be $29.48 an hour. The current wage is $22.68, the company said. The union's sticking points. While making sure grocery workers can make a livable wage is a big concern, Cordova said the top concern is inadequate staffing, and that impacts consumers. Our fight over understaffing is real. Every customer sees that they're waiting in long lines, they're seeing empty shelves, and there's not a supply chain issue here. All the product is in the back room. There's just nobody there to restock, Cordova said. They don't have enough staff in the stores to properly change the price tags or prices in the system. So many customers' experience is the price they're paying is higher than what's advertised. And that's a big issue when people around the country are already upset about the high cost of groceries. Raina Carpenter, the seafood manager at King Soopers in Pueblo, said she joined the company a decade ago when there were 4 people working in a shift in her department at a time. Now there's 2, and sometimes she gets pulled over to the meat department to help. If one of the shift workers is tagging items or restocking, that means there's only 1 employee helping customers. And that's what's happening store-wide, she said. When checkout lines get longer, cashiers abandon and the other chores, that means store shelves aren't getting restocked or properly tagged with the new pricing for the week. Or there's no shopping carts. So another staffer has to run out and gather them up in the parking lot. On ad days, it's ridiculous, said Carpenter, who was also on the union's bargaining committee. You have to rearrange everything. That takes time. We used to have people that came in and worked with us. We had more staffing in the morning and throughout the afternoon. Kroger owns 118 King Soopers and 32 City Market stores in Colorado. Not all are unionized. This story was printed through a news-sharing agreement with the Colorado Sun, a journalist-owned nonprofit based in Denver that covers the state. Advertisement on this page is for the Denver Center for the Performing Arts. See yourself on stage. Theater education at the DCPA. Pre-K, adult. No experience required. One-day workshops, multi-week courses, daytime, evening, and weekend classes. Enroll today. DenverCenter.org/education. Parents, new tax credit could net you thousands. Find out what you need to know by Ann Shimke. Chalkbeat. Photograph accompanying this is a baby grabbing the finger of an adult woman. Caption is, eligible families can get up to $3,200 per child under 6 and up to $2,400 per child from 6 to 16. A new state tax credit worth thousands of dollars is now available to many Colorado families with children under 17. It's called the Family Affordability Tax Credit and is expected to help hundreds of thousands of cash-strapped families across the state. Lawmakers and advocates who champion the credit during last year's legislative session see it as a chance to address Colorado's high cost of living and pick up where the federal government left off when its expanded child tax credit expired in 2021. That expanded tax credit helped cut child poverty in America nearly in half to a historic low of 5.2% in 2021. By 2023, child poverty rates jumped to 13.7%. Since then, several states have expanded or created their own child tax credits. Colorado, which already had a child tax credit for families with young children, created the Family Affordability Credit to provide more financial help to families already getting the child tax credit and give new aid to lower-income families with other children, older children. Here's what you need to know about the new credit. What is the Family Affordability Tax Credit? It's a new state tax credit for lower-income Colorado families with children under 17. It was created during the 2024 legislative session and is now available for the first time to families filing their 2024 tax returns. Eligible families can get a tax credit of up to $3,200 for each child who was 5 or younger as of December 31st, 2024, and up to $2,400 for each child who was 6 to 16 years old as of December 31, 2024. The size of the credit goes down as family income goes up, eventually phasing out when single tax filers hit an adjusted gross income of more than $85,000 a year and joint tax filers hit an adjusted gross income of more than $95,000 a year. How is it different from Colorado's child tax credit? The Family Affordability Tax Credit is much bigger than the state's child tax credit and includes families with older children. For example, a single mother who earned $30,000 in tax year 2024 and has a 4-year-old and 7-year-old would receive a Family Affordability Tax Credit of $4,445 and a state child tax credit of $600. The state child tax credit is only available to lower-income families with children under 6. It's also worth noting that unlike the state child tax credit, the Family Affordability Credit may not be available every year. That's because lawmakers decided to offer it only in good economic times when the state collects enough surplus tax revenue to fund it. During bad years, when the state collects too little surplus tax revenue, the state will reduce the amount of the credit or refrain from offering it at all. How do I know if I'm eligible for Family Affordability Credit? Use the tax credit calculator from Get Ahead Colorado, which is run by the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. The online tool asks a few questions about your income and the number of kids you have and spits out a list of state and federal tax credits you may be eligible for, including the Family Affordability Credit. The tax credit calculator is available in dozens of languages by clicking on the Select Language button in the top right corner. I don't make enough money to pay income taxes. Am I still eligible? Yes. The Family Affordability Tax Credit is refundable. That means that even if eligible families owe nothing in taxes, the state will pay them the amount of the credit as long as they file a state tax return. Families who earn enough to pay income taxes may still get money back if their family affordability credit exceeds the amount they owe the state. I don't have a Social Security number. Am I still eligible? Possibly. Parents who don't have a Social Security number may be eligible for Colorado's Family Affordability Tax Credit if they have an individual taxpayer identification number, or ITIN, and their eligible children have a Social Security number. ITIN numbers are available from the Internal Revenue Service to certain individuals who are categorized as resident aliens or non-resident aliens, regardless of immigration status. Will getting the Family Affordable Tax Credit reduce my SNAP benefits? No. Tax credits are not considered income and will not negatively affect most benefits, including SNAP, TANF, and Medicaid. Are there other tax credits for Colorado families with children? Yes. Both the federal government and the state have earned income tax credits, which are available to lower-income families with or without children. Both offer child tax credits, with the federal version available to qualifying families with children under 17, and the Colorado version available to qualifying families with children under 6. How can I get help filing my tax returns? I apologize. How can I get help filling out my tax returns? You can use myfreetaxes.com, an online program offered through United Way. It's also available in Spanish. Another free option is getyourrefund.org/EN, which allows filers earning under $67,000 a year to get online assistance from certified volunteers. It's also available in Spanish. For free in-person help from certified volunteers, consider the Colorado Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, also known as VITA, VITA. Check this list for VITA sites, hours, and other details. Finally, Get Ahead Colorado has a variety of other tax filing resources available. Reprinted with permission from Chalkbeat, a nonprofit news site covering educational change in public schools. Sign up for their newsletters at ckbe.at/newsletters. Education leaders take closer look at multilingual learners. Photograph ends of a shelf of books with a sign that says Libros en Español. Caption says, in the 2023-24 school year, Colorado identified 114,482 multilingual learners, up from recent years, but still lower than the 2019-20 school year. Photo by Elaine Cromie, Chalkbeat. Education leaders take closer look at multilingual learners. Decline in overall fluency level created challenge, by Yesenia Robles, Chalkbeat. The number of Colorado students who are learning English as a new language is expected to continue to increase, and State Board of Education members are taking a closer look at their performance. The Colorado Department of Education recently presented a state of the state on multilingual learners, the term the state uses to identify students who need services as they learn English as a new language, formerly referred to as English language learners. The presentation signals a greater interest from the state board in how those students are doing. In the 2023-24 school year, Colorado identified 114,482 multilingual learners, up from 109,780 in 2022-23, but still lower than the 122,976 identified in 2019 and 20. Those latest numbers mean about 13.4% of all Colorado students are learning English as a new language, similar to 13.9% in 2019-20. One difference in the population, however, is that a large portion of those students are considered not English proficient, meaning they are at the lowest level of fluency, just starting to learn English. In 2023-24, there were 38,036 students identified as not English proficient, up from 29,147 in 2019. The update reiterated some previous data that shows that this group of students has struggled to recover academically from disruptions in the beginning of the pandemic compared to other students. It also showed that statewide, fewer students are reaching English proficiency test levels that allow them to be considered to exit the need for federally required support services. But it also showed that students who do reach English proficiency and exit services typically score similarly to native English speakers, although a gap remains on the SAT test scores high school students take. When state board members asked about the challenges districts face in educating these students, Education Commissioner Susana Cordova said one of the largest is in finding enough highly qualified staff members who are trained or bilingual for certain models. State board members suggested that one of the ways to look at the effectiveness of school programs to educate English learners would be to look at how students move through language proficiency levels. Students who are learning English as a new language take a test each year and determine their language abilities in speaking, listening, reading, and writing. Students are placed in levels 1 through 6 depending on how much English they understand. Staff for the Colorado Department of Education said January 8th, they believe that it takes students about 5 to 8 years to reach fluency in English at a level adequate for academic learning. They said the department is taking closer looks at tracking students who get stuck and might take longer than that to learn the language. The department is also attempting to highlight more good work schools. The department is also attempting to highlight more good work schools are doing with English learners. Officials started by highlighting the Denver Language School, a charter school that focuses on an immersion model and has about 12% of its students identified as English learners. The school has high ratings and has been improving, officials said. Reprinted with permission from Chalkbeat, a nonprofit news site covering educational change in public schools. Sign up for their newsletters at ckbe.at/newsletters. Moving on to an editorial, Real Estate Today by Jim Smith Realtor. Advertisement on this page is Golden Real Estate's Broker Associates. Golden Real Estate, Jim Smith, broker owner. 303-525-1851. Hometown service delivered with integrity, promoting and modeling environmental responsibility. Colorado Environmental Film Festival returns to Golden on February 21st to 23rd by Jim Smith, Realtor. There's excitement building about the possibility of the Sundance Film Festival coming to Boulder, but we already have a nationally renowned environmental film festival that takes place every February right here in Golden. The Colorado Environmental Film Festival, CEFF, is a juried film festival that lives up to its name, bringing all kinds of film, long form, shorts, children's films, and animated films for a weekend run that includes awards, filmmaker Q&As, and more. I recommend the All Access Pass for $99 because it not only includes entry to all screenings, but also includes streaming access for most of the films for 7 days after the festival. Buy it at ceff.net/tickets. There are 3 screening rooms at the Green Center on the Colorado School of Mines campus, so that's the only way to see your favorite films, which might be scheduled simultaneously. Go to ceff2025.eventive.org/films for a complete list of the films. Plenty to choose from at this year's CEFF, including 9 films with ties to Colorado, 60 plus feature lengths and short films from 17 countries, and 10 world premiere screenings. The weekend also promises thoughtful discussions with filmmakers, panels, and a vibrant eco-expo in which to connect with environmentally conscious brands and organizations. Golden Real Estate has been a sponsor of CEFF for most of its 16 years, so you'll see our ad in the program inviting you to visit our nearby office in downtown Golden. We'll also have a booth at the Eco Expo in the lobby of the Green Center, where we'll have up-to-the-minute displays of all the active solar-powered homes in the Denver MLS. We'd be happy to take you to see any of them. It makes sense that we're the only real estate brokerage sponsoring CEFF because we are experts in all aspects of green building, and half of us drive electric cars. We've also become experts in hardening homes to resist wildfires, so please ask us questions or read some of my previous columns on those topics at www.jimsmithcolumns.com. CEFF groups films by several categories, including activism and environmental justice, adventure, consumption and waste, energy and climate chaos and fossil fuels, health and food, land use and conservation, wildlife, and water, rivers, and oceans. Among the films at this year's festival, I'm personally looking forward to a few particular films. First on that list is Half-Life of Memory, America's Forgotten Atomic Bomb Factory, a 55-minute documentary about the sloppy operation and incomplete cleanup of Rocky Flats, the government's plant between Boulder and Denver, which manufactured the plutonium triggers for thousands of nuclear weapons. As an aside, one of our broker associates, Kathy Jonke, was an environmental geophysicist for the contractor working on site at Rocky Flats during the cleanup. She recommended this film before I saw it was on CEFF's schedule. Ask her sometime about her work. Opening night is Friday the 21st at 7 o'clock in the Green Center's auditorium, featuring an 86-minute feature film, Bring Them Home, about a small group of Blackfoot people who established the first wild buffalo herd on their ancestral lands. It's followed by a discussion with executive producer Melissa Groomhouse. My choice of screenings at 10 a.m. on Saturday is the one which includes Our Movement Starts Here, a documentary about the fight against a toxic landfill in North Carolina. My choice of screenings at 1 p.m. is the one with three films about forests in Canada, Tasmania, and on Washington's Olympic Peninsula. Saturday's 3:30 p.m. screening of four different films includes Way the Wind Blows, a short documentary about one family's journey of recovery from the 2022 Marshall Fire in Boulder County, which destroyed 1,000 homes. That set also includes two interesting films about glaciers. Between the 3:30 screenings and the 7:15 screenings on Saturday will be an evening soiree, a party with drinks and plant-based foods. Tickets for either of those screenings, or the all-access pass, includes an invitation to this party. This is when the awards for the best films will be presented in the Green Auditorium, along with the world premiere screening of The Snake and the Whale, a 90-minute investigative documentary that uncovers antiquated dams on the Lower Snake River that are driving the extinction of fish and killer whales. I'm going to attend the 7:15 set of three films, one of which is Responsible, about the interplay of capitalism and environmentalism. The subtitle of the film is There Is No Business to Be Done on a Broken Planet. On Sunday morning, I have chosen the screenings which include an animated short about invasive fauna and flora in Hawaii, a bird oasis on an abandoned golf course, overgrazing versus regenerative grazing in Nevada, a Tibetan nomad with a camera, and a threatened wetland between the banks of the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. Both of the Sunday morning film screenings are family-friendly and free. Bring the kids. At Sunday's 12:15 p.m. lunch and learn session, hear from members of the Denver Electric Vehicle Council and get the inside scoop on a variety of electric vehicles. Talk to the owners about their real-life experiences driving an EV in Colorado, and check out several models in the electric vehicle roundup outside the Green Center from 9:15 to 3:30. For the 1 p.m. screenings on Sunday, I have chosen the set which has five films focusing on sustainable home construction. This includes The Heart of a Building, PBS program about John Avinson's net zero home in Westminster, which was aired in January on channels 6 and 12. The closing set of screenings starting at 3:30 on Sunday includes The Half-Life of Memory, mentioned above, plus two other films, one about lead poisoning of birds and animals who feed on the carcasses of animals killed with bullets containing lead, plus one about the large amount of water consumed in the manufacture of computer ships. A big part of CEFF's mission is to educate, with a yearly focus on young filmmakers and films aimed at school-age children from grade 4 through high school. These programs are always free, too, so starting at 10 a.m. on Friday, the 21st, prior to the festival's opening, there's a CEFF 4 classrooms field trip in the Bunker Auditorium at the Green Center. It is for schools, youth organizations, homeschools, and more, designed to share a variety of youth-friendly environmental films in addition to showing 9 short films, 2 of them by young filmmakers. It includes a Q&A session with filmmakers and other field experts related to the film topics. Register at info@ceff.net. Next article. Still editorial. ADU law enables homeowners to invest on their own lot. Beginning in July, homeowners in Colorado will be able to create an accessory dwelling unit, ADU, within their home, preferably a walkout basement, over their detached garage, or by building a tiny home or casita in their backyard. The enabling law was HB24-1152. Until this law was passed, local zoning regulations made it difficult to get approval to build an ADU, but now local governments cannot block ADU development using zoning regulations, although other local laws, such as building codes, still apply. Many homes, such as single-story homes with no basement and a small lot with no detached garage, will not be able to take advantage of this law, but many others can. And that's the purpose of the law, namely to increase the housing supply through increased density. Before this new law, there wasn't much that Colorado homeowners could do to increase the housing supply. Now they can, and increase their wealth in the process. In September, Colorado Biz had an article that described how the law works. ADUs add housing units with minimal impacts to infrastructure and with increased compact infill development. They provide intergenerational living options and enable child or elder care and aging in place. Because they're small, ADU rents are typically low. The financial information for a specific ADU varies greatly dependent on the particular ADU and site costs. That makes the numbers used in the article only rough estimates. The cost of an ADU is dependent on choices made by the homeowner who is installing the unit. It can be very expensive, but there are ways to keep it reasonable. Regardless, the article is a helpful summary. One of the many reasons cited for expanding the use of ADUs is to increase the availability of affordable housing. Although this rationale has been questioned, there are many things that can make ADUs cost-effective, thus increasing affordability, both for purchase and rent. Two of the factors that contribute to affordability are the size of the units and the cost of the land. ADUs are small, but not uncomfortably small, and day-to-day life is unchanged. They tap into a trend of smaller living spaces. For a homeowner considering putting in an ADU, it's one real estate investment that includes no cost for land. ADUs use space that is, at best, underutilized and already owned. This is a big plus where the value of land is high. As part of the new law, the legislature appropriated money and tasked the Colorado Housing and Finance Authority, CHFA, to develop programs to enable homeowners with moderate means to afford construction of an ADU. The idea is to jumpstart ADU finance in the private sector. Finally, units assembled off-site, referred to as manufactured, modular, or prefab, can reduce costs significantly and have other advantages such as shorter lead times, far less on-site construction, environmental benefits, etc. A Colorado company that specializes in manufactured detached ADUs is Verdant Living, www.verdantliving.us. The owner of that company, John Phillips, is happy to discuss ADU options with you. Because of the huge variety of situations where ADUs are possible, he tries to recommend options that might work, often not involving his company. He can be reached at 303-717-1962, voice or text. His is a Denver business. Another player in the field of manufactured housing on the national level is Boxable, www.boxable.com. which specializes in factory-made homes that literally unfold after being delivered on a standard width flatbed trailer. Its Casita is a 361-square-foot modular home offering a stylish, efficient living space with a kitchen, bathroom, and bedroom. It's delivered with all electric appliances, including laundry, and 100-amp electrical service. It is currently priced at $60,000. It must be installed on a foundation prepared with electrical and plumbing hookups. It is built to meet building codes. Recently, the company introduced the Baby Box, a 120-square-foot living space built to RV standards. Easy setup, no special equipment or foundation needed. The MSRP of Baby Box is $30,000, with introductory pricing of $19,999. It comes like a mobile home on a frame with permanent wheels. It too has a bathroom and kitchen, but with water tank and waste tank like any RV, it is intended for delivery to mobile home parks. Johnston to talk sanctuary laws with Congress, by Caitlin Kim, Denverite. Denver Mayor Mike Johnston is going to Washington. He'll testify in front of the Republican-controlled House Oversight Committee, along with the mayors of three other Democratic cities, about their policies around new immigrants. A spokesperson for Johnston says the mayor and the committee reached an agreement for him to appear, noting, "For the last 2 years, Denver has shown the country that you can be a compassionate and welcoming city without sacrificing public safety or core services. We look forward to discussing with the committee." Johnston joins New York City Mayor Eric Adams, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, and Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, who gave birth to her third child on January 13th, in agreeing to appear on March 5th. Originally, they'd been called to appear on February 11th. Kentucky Rep. James Comer is leading an investigation into what he called the policies of sanctuary jurisdictions and their impact on public safety and federal enforcement. "Sanctuary mayors owe the American people an explanation for city policies that jeopardize public safety and violate federal immigration law by releasing dangerous criminal illegal aliens back onto the streets. These reckless policies in Democrat-run cities and states across our nation have led to too many preventable tragedies," the Republican said in a statement announcing the hearing. "The policies in Boston, Chicago, Denver, and New York City prioritize criminal illegal aliens over the American people. This is unacceptable, and their leaders must be held accountable. Denver is considered a welcoming city for immigrants, not a sanctuary city state. Not a sanctuary city. State and local laws limit how the police can work with federal immigration forces. Cooperation is generally allowed in criminal cases, but officers can't turn over people based on their immigration status alone. Any restrictions aimed at protecting undocumented immigrants have been in the crosshairs for congressional Republicans and the Trump administration, and the hearing will likely be a combative one. Colorado has one member serving in the Oversight Committee, Republican Rep. Lauren Boebert, on an immigration hardliner. In a social media post on January 29th, Boebert wrote, "The days of sanctuary states like Colorado and sanctuary cities like Denver are quickly coming to an end under President Trump." Johnston may see another Colorado face in Washington, Rep. Gabe Evans, who was recently elected to Congress to represent the 8th Congressional District, said he was set to join the committee that day. This story is from Denverite, a Denver news site, used by permission. For more and to support Denverite, visit denverite.com. Photograph accompanying this is of Mayor Johnston at a podium. Caption is, "Denver Mayor Mike Johnston presents his priorities for 2025 during a public meeting at Denver Public Library's Central Branch, January 29th, 2025. Advertisement on this page, "Reverse Mortgages Made Easy. Call me to schedule your free, confidential in-home review of this unique product." It's a photo of a man in a suit. Mike Bruja, Reverse Mortgage Specialist, NMLS number 971223. Cell phone 720-435-0653. Reverse Mortgage of Colorado, helping those in my community with the mortgage needs for over 36 years. Denver mayor vetoes city council bill to expand needle exchange sites. By Ernest Gurule, special to Colorado Community Media. There will be no additional sanctioned needle exchange sites in Denver, despite a Denver City Council vote to expand that number. Denver Mayor Mike Johnston made sure of that by announcing a veto of the council vote just a day after the mid-January vote passed. He called it the wrong solution at the wrong time. There are currently three city-sanctioned needle exchange sites in Denver, and for now, that number will remain unchanged. Each site also offers information about drug treatment options, as well as mental health information. Drugs are not available at the locations, and no drugs are used or available on site. At the January meeting, the City Council voted 8-5 on an ordinance that would have allowed an increase in the number of locations where used needles could be turned in, and where clean needles would be obtained. Wording in the proposed new ordinance would have allowed new sites in areas zoned for medical offices. The new law also erased a provision establishing a 1,000-foot buffer between each site and schools or daycare centers. "I could not support it," District 7 Councilwoman Flor Alvidrez said. "The ordinance," she said, "removes the cap on the number of needle exchanges without tying it to any demonstrable need." Alvidrez said it also eliminates safe zones for daycare facilities and schools. She said she would not risk children's safety. Safety buffers were also a reason for a no vote from Councilmember Kevin Flynn, who represents Council District 2. While Flynn said he supports relocating Capitol Hill's Harm Reduction Action Center as a needle exchange site, a provision in the ordinance, "I am open to raising the cap on the number of programs, but not removing it entirely. That is not what the bill did." Drug overdoses have long plagued the country. Denver and Colorado are no different, according to the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. There were 1,865 fatal drug overdoses in the state, including 467 in Denver in 2023. Of that number, 1,298 were men, 567 were women. The age group 39 to 44 showed the highest number of overdose fatalities with 481. Following Denver in fatal drug overdoses were El Paso County, 220, Arapahoe County, 209, and Adams County, 198. Overdose deaths by ethnicity included 1,325 non-Hispanic, 425 Hispanic, and 176 African American. Drug overdoses in Colorado in 2023 touched all age demographics. The state recorded 4 overdoses of young people, 14 and younger. There were 31 overdose deaths of people aged 75 and older. Last year's overdose fatality statistics are not yet available. It's unlikely they will show a jump like the one recorded between 2019 and 2020, when the state had its biggest jump. That 12-month period showed overdose deaths jumped 38%. Drug overdoses, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, are the number one cause of death in the United States for both men and women in that same age group. In 2021, the U.S. recorded the highest number of drug overdoses ever, with more than 106,000 fatalities. Synthetic opioids were the leading cause of death, with slightly more than 70,000 attributed to fentanyl. Methamphetamine, heroin, and cocaine were also among the leading overdose drugs. The CDC said African Americans' drug overdoses skyrocketed by 44% between 2020 and 2021. Newly elected Denver District Attorney John Walsh, who also served as the U.S. Attorney for the District of Colorado from 2010 to 2016, endorsed the mayor's veto of the needle exchange expansion. "Needle exchange programs serve a valuable role," Walsh said. The new city prosecutor said they reduce harm from dangerous drugs and prevent the spread of disease transmission. But, he said, "it's not clear to me that Denver's existing program needs to be expanded at this point, beyond the 3 existing needle exchange sites." Currently, the 3 needle exchange sites in the city are the Harm Reduction Action Center in Capitol Hill, the Colorado Health Network in Uptown, and LifePoint, a mobile-only site. Photograph accompanying this article shows a bin containing many, many syringes. Caption says, used needle disposal inside the Harm Reduction Action Center, August 30th, 2017. Photo by Kevin J. Beatty, Denverite. Advertisement on this screen. Add filtered water. Cook with love. Denver Water. Lead Reduction Program. Learn more at denverwater.org/lead. Colorado tied for most educated state. Massachusetts pulls even for residence credentials by Jason Gonzalez, Chalkbeat. Colorado residents are still the most educated in the nation, but Massachusetts now shares the top spot, according to a report released in January. This year's Stronger Nation report found that 63% of Colorado residents age 25 and older had an education credential beyond high school diploma in 2023. Matching Massachusetts, that's above the national average of 54.9% of residents who have earned college degrees or certificates or an industry certification. The figure is mostly unchanged from 2022, when about 62.9% of Colorado's residents held a college credential. However, the percentage of Native American Colorado residents with college degrees or credentials has fallen, a troubling sign after years of steady increases. The annual report from the Lumina Foundation aims for a national goal of 60% college attainment. Lumina is a funder of Chalkbeat. Having an education beyond a high school diploma matters because it is crucial for state economic growth and individual financial success, as high-wage jobs typically require a college credential. Disparities persist. Colorado has long been among the most educated states, but racial disparities persist. While most racial group data remains steady, Native American college attainment fell for the second consecutive year. About 30.5% of Native American residents in 2023 held a college credential, a 3.2% decline from 2022. The drop stems from fewer college graduates aged 25 to 34. Only 22.3% of Native American residents in that age category have education beyond high school, now the lowest of any racial group in Colorado. Hispanic residents had for years been the least likely to have a college education, but steady gains have changed that. Now 30.6% hold a post-secondary credential. Meanwhile, 41.7% of Black, 63.1% of White, and 66.1% of Asian Americans residents have a credential or higher. Reprinted with permission from Chalkbeat, a nonprofit news site covering educational change in public schools. Sign up for their newsletters at ckbe.at/newsletters. Advent Health Parker fights human trafficking. Facility trains nurses in ways to spot victims by Haley Lena, H. Lena, at coloradocommunitymedia.com. Accompanying photograph is a classroom setting with adults paying attention to a speaker at a podium. Caption says, Janelle Goodrich, founder and executive director of the nonprofit From Silenced to Saved, speaks with emergency room nurses with Advent Health Parker to learn how to identify and support potential human trafficking victims that come into the hospital. As the FBI continues to monitor the rise of human trafficking in Colorado, particularly cases involving youth, various agencies and organizations across the state are working to combat the crime. But one sector is on the front lines. I think healthcare workers come across human trafficking victims more than any of us, said Janelle Goodrich, founder and executive director of From Silenced to Saved, a nonprofit organization that supports victims of sexual exploitation. Research including studies published in the National Institute of Health shows that more than 60% of those being trafficked had visited an emergency room while being exploited. That reality was brought to Mary Marnell's attention during the COVID-19 pandemic while working in the emergency department at the Medical Center of Aurora. While working outside alongside a coworker, two young girls approached them. After they walked away, Marnell's coworker told them those two girls were likely being trafficked, sparking Marnell to want to learn more about human trafficking in the area. When Marnell began working as an emergency room nurse at Advent Health Parker shortly after, she wanted to bring more awareness to human trafficking, but noticed there weren't a lot of resources that were easily accessible. And I'm afraid that is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining me for Denver Metro News, read by Matt.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.